Today on Straight Talk Africa, combating terrorism in Africa, from Al-Shabaab to Boko Haram. Do they really have any legitimate grievances, as some observers claim? That's coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America here in Washington. It's Wednesday, April 15th. I am Shaka Sali. My colleague and social media reporter, Maria Majaro, is off today. Today, we'll discuss combating terrorism across Africa and the ongoing efforts by governments and the international community to restore peace and stability. And later on the program, we'll reveal some of your excellent social media comments on our topic. But first, acts of terror continue to wreak havoc and claim innocent lives in parts of Somalia, Kenya, and Nigeria. My colleague, Paul Sisko, has more.
Al-Shabaab, again. The Islamist militants attacked a government building in the Somali capital, Mogadishu, Tuesday. Two blasts. 18 are killed. In Kenya, the grieving endures for the Garissa University students, 148 killed, executed, really, by Al-Shabaab terrorists April 2nd. And this week, from Abuja in Nigeria to Washington, D.C., and on social media worldwide, renewed pleas and demands for the still-missing 218 Chibok young women kidnapped by Boko Haram a year ago. Jamila Feghi, with the Voice of America's House of Service, moderated a panel discussion Tuesday marking the anniversary.
Today, it's been a year, a very painful year for so many parents, but also for Nigerians as well, because it actually marks and proves the incompetency, not only for the government to tackle Boko Haram, but to protect its citizens.
U.S. Congresswoman Karen Bass.
No matter what else is going on in the world, we must remember their plight. We have to do everything we can to end the reign of terror of Boko Haram. Everybody knows that since the girls were kidnapped, many other Nigerian girls and boys have been kidnapped or killed for committing the crime of wanting an education.
Patients now attend school in the United States. The former Chibok student escaped from Boko Haram.
Just like these girls, I moved to the U.S. for education. I am a mother. I have sisters. I know some of the girls that is not part of the abducted girls, but I know the ones that are also abducted. I understand the power of education. I really hope 365 days has enabled most of you to understand that if you educate a girl, you educate the world. And if you educate a man, you educate one.
Another message from Nobel Peace Prize winner Malala Yousafzai.
To my brave sisters, the kidnapped schoolgirls of Chibok, I look forward to the day I can hug each one of you, pray with you, and celebrate your freedom with your families. Until then, stay strong and never lose hope. You are my heroes. Your sister, Malala.
You are not forgotten. You are not alone. Paul Sisko, VOA News.
Thanks, Paul, for that report. Now joining us here in our Washington studios are two distinguished guests. Lola Adele, also co-founder of Act for Accountability, a Nigerian-American advocacy group based here in Washington, D.C., and Dr. Raymond Gilpin, Dean of the Africa Center for Strategic Studies at the National Defense University here in the nation's capital. Of course, I have to say, frankly, that once again, I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you for having me.
You're most welcome. And Raymond, where have you been all this time?
I've been busy traveling the continent,
witnessing some of the innovative ways that Africans are addressing the challenges that face them, mm-hmm. and being optimistic about the future.
Really? Well, we'll wait for you, of course, to share a little bit of that with us and our audience.
Thank you.
Later in the program, we'll give you, the audience, a chance to call and talk with our guests. The number to call is 202-619-3111. U.S. country code is 1. But before we begin today's discussion, I am joined by my colleague, Anne Luke, VOA West Africa correspondent, who joins us via Skype from the Senegalese capital, Dakar. Good evening, Anne.
Hi, good evening.
Oh, of course, it's a pleasure having you online after a very, very long time. Yesterday, you obviously might have heard that Nigerian President-elect Major General Buhari retired, but certainly not tired, said that he cannot promise the girls will be found. We are talking about the Chibok girls. Your reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's not super unexpected from Buhari. He's known to be kind of a tough talker, tell it like it is. But it is a departure from the government line. For example, a father of one of the Chibok girls told us just this weekend that when he had met with President Goodluck Jonathan at the villa last year, they had just been told, be patient, the girls will come home sooner or later, just sit tight. So this is definitely a departure, an effort to be more honest, to use Mr. Buhari's terms.
Of course, I also recall that a government spokesman at one time promised us that within a couple of weeks, the girls will be free. What happened, really? Does anyone believe what they hear from Abuja in as far as the girls are concerned?
No, and I think that's one reason, and that's how the Chibok girls became kind of emblematic of the larger public outrage in terms of the government's dealing with Boko Haram. You know, there have been several fumbles by the government and the military. You know, at one point they claimed to have rescued them. Another time they claimed they'd be rescued within weeks. Last October they claimed there was a ceasefire deal being negotiated and the girls would come home. So it's really eroded the public trust.
When you talk to people, what sense do you get? I know that you've been across Nigeria, you've been to Mali, you've been across the West African subcontinent, really. Are people worried as much about terrorism as we seem to be worried about it right here in Washington, for example?
No, I don't get this. People don't really talk about it as terrorism with a capital T. You know, for example, in northern Nigeria, talking to IDPs, people who survived Boko Haram's attacks, it's much more of just a sense of disbelief. How could the government let this happen to me? How could the world let this happen to me? You know, somebody needs to come and help us. I remember northern Mali, there was, when I visited after it was liberated from the Islamists, there was a lot of disgust among the population for the locals who had collaborated, for example, with Mujao and AQIM. And there was a real effort to express their rejection of this and how much they didn't believe in this.
What about the fact that the country just elected, of course, a man that was once a military general, a man, in fact, that was even a military head of state, and a man, frankly, who has impeccable credentials, especially when it comes to the issue of discipline. Do they believe that he is the right man, perhaps, that could end this tragedy in the northern part of Nigeria?
Yeah, I think that's what helped him quite a bit in the campaign. He did downplay a bit of his military history as a military ruler, but, you know, it's been long understood that there are problems within the Nigerian military. There's corruption, there's issues of training, equipment, you know, there's even some people talk about laziness or cowardliness. And so there was a sentiment among voters that this man can come in and clean stuff up and toughen things up, and he perhaps, unlike other political leaders of the country, he perhaps, as a former military general himself, can talk to them, can work with them in a more efficient manner.
You know, and of course, when we talk about Boko Haram, it didn't begin yesterday. It began back in 2009. Does anybody believe that this thing, in fact, can end with a military solution? Or perhaps they should look for some other options? Perhaps, in fact, seriously, talk to the terrorists, just like the government in Afghanistan is talking with the Taliban.
Yeah, but I think Boko Haram, even though there have been, you know, overtures at talks and discussions and negotiations, the true hardline sect within Boko Haram, you know, led by Abubakar Shekau, has pretty consistently shown themselves to be against negotiation and not open to talking. So, but that doesn't mean the solution is entirely military. I mean, even right now, we're seeing all these impressive gains. Nigerian and regional troops are taking back major towns. But now they have to hold that territory, and they need to govern that territory, and they need to govern it perhaps in a better and more present way than they did before to address some of the grievances that, you know, fed Boko Haram in those early days.
Well, thank you very much, Anne. It was a pleasure, of course, having you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. Now we move to the East African part of the continent, and we are joined by correspondent Gabe Joselo. Good evening, Gabe.
Good evening, Shaka.
How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks.
I understand that you are in Khartoum, of course, the Sudanese capital.
That's right, yes. I'm talking to you from Khartoum.
Covering elections. What about the terrorism aspect that you are covering in Kenya, where you are based? What can you tell us about it?
About terrorism in Kenya, obviously we had a devastating attack at the beginning of the month in Garissa when there were 148 people killed, mostly students at a university in the town, which is in the northeastern part of Kenya. You know, since then there's been a lot of controversy and a lot of finger-pointing and questions asked about who is really to blame for this attack and what can Kenya do to better secure its citizens.
Do we know why that campus was not effectively guarded by the Kenyan security forces?
That's exactly one of the questions people are asking. If you would recall, a few days before the attack, Kenyan universities were warning students and faculty that Al-Shabaab was planning an attack on an institution, probably a university. So there was a heads up that this could happen. And we were told that the university in Garissa employed a couple of extra guards, but not nearly enough, obviously, to stop that just egregious attack.
You know, I remember that reading about during the Second World War, FDR, I'm talking about President Roosevelt, talking about warning Americans, frankly, that all we fear is fear itself. What about the fact that it seems to me that, in fact, what you are having in Kenya right now is something akin to that? I am looking at the example of what happened at the University of Nairobi Kikuyu campus. You have an electric defect, and you have a lot of noise that somehow is connected to weapons, you know, fire and all that kind of stuff. And students begin to jump from the sixth floor of their dormitories, frankly, to escape who they thought were terrorists.
Well, that's right. I think in Kenya is a particularly traumatized place after the Westgate attack in September 2013. That was, you know, if you recall, that's when Al-Shabaab came in and took over one of the fanciest malls in Nairobi. And so since then, yeah, the country's been a bit jumpy. At the same time, Al-Shabaab has proven that with just a handful of militants, they can cause a lot of damage. They can kill a lot of people, and they can strike rather unpredictably. So I think on one hand, the fear factor is a bit overblown, but on the other, there is a real threat out there.
How do you respond to some voices which are wondering as to whether, in fact, there is anybody in charge of the store in as far as Kenya is concerned?
I think that there's been a lot of criticism lobbed at the government, basically, for not doing enough on the terror front. But I think it's important to recognize, first of all, that, you know, soldiers have died in the fight against terrorism, that there are individual sacrifices that shouldn't be overlooked. But, yes, there are giant institutional problems, and there's weakness, especially in the northeastern region where Garissa is and along the border. And it's going to take some major reforms and probably some concrete efforts to fight corruption, to upgrade equipment, to work with partners in the region to finally do something that can make the situation better and safer for Kenya.
What about criticism from former Kenyan Prime Minister Raila Odinga, of course, who happens to be the leader of CORD, the main opposition group, who has been saying that perhaps what the government needs to do really is to withdraw the Kenyan Defense Force back to the country so that it can take care of the borders. Is that something that people are taking seriously?
Yes, I think Raila Odinga's followers are certainly taking that seriously. The president, the Jubilee administration, has they've refused to really consider that option. And I think it is a tricky decision for them because you can't argue the fact that Kenya's contribution to the African Union mission in Somalia has removed al-Shabaab from a lot of its strongholds. I mean, al-Shabaab was close to taking over the whole country back in, like, 2006. So the fact that they have been removed from the cities that they held is, you know, one of the reasons that they are lashing out the way they are at Kenya. So in a strange way, Kenya is a victim of its own success in Somalia. At the same time, al-Shabaab has said over and over again that the reason they are attacking is because of Kenya's involvement. So it stands to reason that maybe if Kenya were to pull out and secure the border, they could stop these attacks. I think, but for those reasons, it's a tricky decision. It's a tough call for Kenya.
Thank you very much, Gabe, for your insight. And, of course, good luck on your coverage of the election in Sudan, which some critics are calling a selection. Now we'll pause for a short break and would like to remind you that Straight Talk Africa is now on the social networking website Twitter, and we are tweeting live. Follow us at VOA Shaka, that's VOA Shaka, and join in on today's discussion with your questions and comments. Don't forget to use the hashtag VOA Combat Terror. And we are still on Facebook. Just enter the keyword Straight Talk Africa. Become a fan and connect with other friends of the Voice of America. We'll be right back with you, so please don't go away.
I wanted to present music and a side of American culture that is most important to me, that is a part of who I am. They're going to get some incredible performances. That's one of the things I love, bringing these artists in so you can get to see them do what they do. It's soul music, and that's what music is. It's that which comes from the soul.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. What is your opinion about today's topic? Call us at 202-619-3111. U.S. country code 1. When you call, remember the following. Ask only one question. Keep your comment brief and turn down the volume on your radio or television. Now let's return to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Githui, and welcome back. Today we are discussing combating terrorism across Africa and the ongoing efforts by governments and the international community to restore peace and stability. Our distinguished guests are Laura Odere Oso, co-founder of Act for Accountability, a Nigerian-American advocacy group based here in Washington, D.C., and Dr. Raymond Gilpin, Dean of the Africa Center for Strategic Studies at the National Defense University here in the nation's capital. Again, of course, I am profoundly honored and extremely gratified to have the opportunity to host the two of you again on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. You obviously had my colleagues share with us their views and their impressions of what is happening first in Nigeria. We're talking about Boko Haram and, of course, later in Kenya, and of course we might add Somalia because of al-Shabaab. Now, what about you, Laura? Yesterday, of course, was the 1 year anniversary, of course, since the girls were kidnapped. Your impressions?
Where do I start? Well, we are still waiting, and I just see that there are opportunities, and they have been missed opportunities. With the present administration, unfortunately, not enough was done quickly. We know that, as I think it was Anne who said, well, there were reports not long after the insurgency happened that the military had found the girls, and then we found out that was a lie. Then they said that, oh, we're going to get them in a few weeks. That was another lie. And so it's been this game of what's the truth. Sometimes I say truth is optional in Nigeria because it doesn't matter what they throw out there, they'll just say whatever. And then we realize that the painful part is parents who are waiting. They are hoping and waiting on every opportunity to figure out what is their government doing to get their daughters back? What are the opportunities to make sure that they are safe? Boko Haram keeps attacking. More kidnaps since those girls. And yet, it just seems that the lack of political will to do anything has been this game we've been playing with the present's outgoing administration.
I remember, of course, when you talk about how the military told lies about the fact that they knew where the girls were and that, in fact, within a couple of weeks, the girls would be freed. I remember I had you on the show, and you were not particularly persuaded.
No.
You thought that perhaps it was a sort of political ploy.
It is. It has been a political ploy. They've done everything. People have to remember, the elections we just had has been an ongoing game. They've been prepping for this election for quite a while. So anything that would help them get this favorable image out there is what they were doing. But at the end of this game are the lives of these girls and the lives of the families. We have parents who've died waiting for their children to come home, and yet it just did not seem that there was any concern about the fact that they are lying. You know, how can, if we cannot trust that the representatives who are speaking on behalf of our government will tell us the truth, then what are we going to do?
Raymond, do you by any chance believe or do you by any chance agree with Lola on this? Because the last time I checked, I thought the soldiers were supposed to be quote-unquote public servants. They are not supposed to be card-carrying members of the ruling PDP. Why would they be playing politics that is likely to favor the man sitting in Aso Rock?
No, it's a very difficult conundrum. We have, on the one hand, we have small groups of extremists who are terrorizing an entire nation and an entire region. And the way they do it is to spread not just fear, but also spread uncertainty in the minds of people. And this kind of happens in areas that are not really well governed. And that we have a serious governance deficit, whether you're talking about Al-Shabaab in the east or the Maghreb issue or northern or the Sahelian issue or northern northeast Nigeria, it's the same thing. The problem with most of the countries is that we have militaries that were trained for traditional soldiering, i.e. protecting territorial integrity.
Right.
And that is very statist in orientation. And here we have small groups of non-state actors that infiltrate communities and are difficult, A, to identify and, B, to dislodge. And so when you have the traditional military going in, one, there is a possibility that they could become stooges of the political masters. But in the second, it's a bewilderment. They weren't trained for this. And so what the promises they make are not promises that they probably believe they can keep.
But if what you are saying is true, then how do you respond to someone who will say, wait a minute, Raymond, this is perhaps the same military which was at the head of ECOMOG, which routed the revolutionary United Front belonging to Lance Corporal Fode Sanko in Sierra Leone?
Correct. That was an insurgency.
It's different, a different kettle of fish.
What is the difference between an insurgency and a terrorist group?
Well, in this particular instance, the insurgency was a homegrown militia for the Sanko and the RUF, mm-hmm. trying to, A, stake claim to their quote-unquote rights, mm-hmm. and, B, topple the government. And so there was a clear sense of, A, messaging, B, tactics, mm-hmm. and C, purpose.
So would you, in fact, equate them with being, quote-unquote, freedom fighters, the RUF?
Probably in their minds, they may have thought they were, but I think they were misguided.
What about the minds of their supporters?
And that's why it was easy for them after the transition for them to become a political party, because they believed that they had a legitimate grievance. They became a political party. They put their grievances on the table and they lost the elections. However, with Boko Haram, the issue becomes having this group infiltrate these ungoverned and unserviced areas, mm-hmm. you have two dynamics at play. One, there is a fear dynamic. Mm-hmm. But second, there's a service provision dynamic, mm. where the government has kind of abdicated its responsibility, not just to protect, but to provide for the civilians. These groups go in, they wreak havoc, but at the same time, they provide some basic services. And so it's easy for them to be integrated into society. So it's very difficult. It's a more difficult proposition from a military standpoint, which is why I think you made the point earlier that addressing things like Boko Haram requires a lot more than a military solution. Mm-hmm. It requires a lot more than a military solution. And I think that's one of the areas in which African countries are missing the point, i.e., it's not all about going after the group. It's about addressing the governance deficit. It's about service provision. It's about addressing inequality and redefining security.
I think there's also a part of it that has to do with reconciliation. Mm-hmm. For so long, the northern region of Nigeria has felt that they don't matter, in that, you know, it's the most underdeveloped portion of the country. Mm-hmm. Education is pretty failing in that region.
Why is it underdeveloped? I know historically, of course, the British sort of disregarded
them. The British did not think that they were intellectual enough, and then they would hand over power to them. But then, of course, we know what happened with whether it's in the East and then killing leaders and so on and so forth. So the North has had this, I think, that has been underplayed when it comes to its role in Nigeria.
But there was a time when they seemed to dominate power, really.
And that's where I was going.
And they had a sort of affirmative action. When I was in school, for example, in the 1980s, you had a lot of Nigerians coming from the north.
Yes.
Who had scholarships to study anything you could think about.
The north, they are very, very intellectual, smart people in the north. But it all has always been a situation where it's been a small population of the people in the north
characterize as the Kaduna Mafia.
Shaka, to add here, you asked why has the north been so underdeveloped. I think oil is what, you know, shifted the balance.
And of course it is in the Niger Delta.
Exactly.
But ironically, it used to be, I think, refined in the north.
Well, correct.
What happened?
Yes.
Correct. Because what happened was, once oil became the focus for Nigeria,
yes,
everything moved to the east and the south.
It became a game changer.
Yes.
It became a game changer. And economically, there's something that they call the Dutch disease. Lot of oil money comes in really quickly, it artificially inflates your currency, and everything else you do becomes uncompetitive. So all the industries in the north started suffering.
Exactly. They were underdeveloped.
And that's when the history of the political economy of Nigeria is fraught with excesses, corruption, etc.
Yes.
And just siphoned everything, resources, attention, away from the north. And today we are suffering because of that.
Very interesting. Unfortunately, the time happens not to be our best ally. Lola, we'll come back to that.
No,
you're tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment, so please don't go away.
Like Voice of America on Facebook.
follow VOA on Twitter. Join VOA on our YouTube channel. Like, follow, join VOA.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. Call us now with your questions and comments. The number 202-619-3111. And the U.S. country code is 1. Call direct and we'll call you right back. Remember to keep your questions brief. Now back to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Gizuya. And of course, welcome back to Straight Talk Africa, live from Washington. It's time now for our letter of the week. Gerald Mutenga from Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, writes, African governments can effectively fight terrorism by uniting in solidarity and patriotism. If we do that, we'll be able to combat terrorism once and for all. It will be difficult because our leaders are corrupt and misuse the power of their government offices. Everyone cares about themselves and not for the benefit of society as a whole. We have received outstanding feedback to this week's question. Terrorist groups such as Al-Shabaab and Boko Haram are tearing apart African communities and robbing young people of their futures by constraining economic growth and denying them the opportunity to get an education. African governments and their global partners like the United States have no higher priority than protecting their citizens from attack by violent extremists. This leads us to our question of the week, which asks, how can African governments effectively combat radical terror groups like Al-Shabaab and Boko Haram? Thanks for using social media to communicate with us. Let's begin with a comment from Erdem in Brooklyn, New York, who writes, to shut down terrorist groups, African countries must join forces. Unity is strength. If the whole continent is united, they can crush these infamous terrorist groups in East and West Africa. Another reminder that we are tweeting live today. Use the hashtag VOA Combat Terror. And if you haven't yet, please follow us at VOA Shaka. Now, let's go to a tweet from Ahmed Ibrahim, who writes, African governments must embark on job creation and strengthen its regional ties. We have another tweet from Twitter follower Ebenezer Emmanuel, who says, through ensuring and strengthening good relationships between the people and their governments, avoid biases and service quality to all. How do you respond to that, Laura?
They're pretty much talking about the same thing we are.
Pretty much what you guys were talking about.
Yeah, that it has to go beyond a military response.
So why do governments have to spend millions and perhaps billions of their local currencies, frankly, buying weapons to kill their own people? Why not negotiate seriously? Because let's face it, when you talk about terrorism, you are reminded of 9/11, correct? So we're talking about Afghanistan and the Taliban. But the last time I checked, there were reports at one time that even the United States, in fact, was negotiating with Taliban in Doha, in Qatar. And in fact, the Taliban negotiate with their own government.
It's unfortunate. I think one of the challenges I was mentioned in one of the quotes, buying ammunition and arms trade plus corruption equals someone makes a lot of money.
Yes.
Or someone's are making a lot of money. So there's incentive for them to keep buying ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
That's one part. The other part is when you look at this, the history and the tensions within the country, who does it benefit to keep a certain part of a country quote-unquote under control or destabilized? Exactly. If you can keep them destabilized, then there are other ways in which you can keep control of the country.
Interesting.
So those are two thoughts that I have. And I just wanted to...
What about Raymond? You are in a position, by the way, you have really a vantage point. you interact with some of Africa's best and brightest soldiers, don't you?
Absolutely, yes, we do. And
what do they talk about? Things like terrorism, really? You know, or what do you, in fact, teach them?
Terrorism is something that's really difficult to put one's finger on. I completely agree with the broad sentiment expressed that we do need a comprehensive approach to terrorism. There's a sense in which we need a security presence where you have small groups that are wreaking havoc, a sense in which you need to improve governance, a sense in which you also need to provide economic opportunity. But, Shaka, if you think about it, and you think over the recent history of extremism in Africa, it's very difficult to put your finger on what is a terrorist group.
Mm-hmm.
Some are ideologically driven.
Mm-hmm.
Others have territorial ambition.
Mm-hmm.
And some are state-sponsored.
So you might agree perhaps to, you know, with some who in fact say one man's or one person's terrorist might in fact be another person's freedom fighter.
That is correct.
Because look at the examples of a man like the Madiba. Nelson Mandela himself, the ANC, the African National Congress. You remember when, during the Reagan administration, it was dubbed here a terrorist organization. Yeah. And Madiba, of course, was a terrorist. But guess what? He's probably, even in his own death right now, probably the closest thing, frankly, to an internationally celebrated political patron saint. What about Menachem Begin, a one-time prime minister of Israel? You remember the time when he was fighting, of course, for the freedom of his people. He was associated with a Zionist militant group known as Irgun. I remember what he did to King David's Hotel and the people that died, and the British, who were, of course, the colonialists at the time, they basically dubbed him a terrorist. There was a time when he became prime minister. You remember he was the prime minister between 1977 to 83. There was a time when he was coming, in fact, right here to attend a meeting, I think, at Camp David, actually, with then-president Jimmy Carter. And for his plane to be allowed to refuel in the United Kingdom, they had to remove his name from a terrorist group.
Yeah, but, Shaka, I do agree with you that, and even if you look at this nation's history.
Mm-hmm.
Our founding fathers were considered terrorists by the British.
General.
However, there's a big difference between those personalities and the leaders of groups like Al-Shabaab and Boko Haram.
And what is that difference?
I think we have...
What is that difference? Because in Al-Shabaab, I'm sure you are aware of a story of this law graduate, a Kenyan who came from well-to-do background. His father was a mid-level government official. He attended the University of Nairobi Law School, graduated, and joined Al-Shabaab.
Correct.
You also know that there are a lot of Somali in the diaspora who have been moving from Europe, from their comfort zones, moving from Minneapolis, Minnesota, joining Al-Shabaab. These are not crazy people, are they?
Correct. No, the point, Shaka, is that the difference between people like Nelson Mandela and the leaders of Al-Shabaab and Boko Haram is that while you could see whether you're talking about Nelson Mandela or others, there is a clear set of issues that they are pushing for. Progress,
legitimate concerns,
prosperity,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, legitimacy is something that we could debate.
Yes.
But there was a clear sense in which they were moving towards an end state for the people.
Okay.
In the case of groups like Al-Shabaab and
Boko Haram,
the requests, the tactics, the outcomes are as confusing as they are dastardly, and they're advancing nothing other than the interests of that small group.
I'll come to that, and we can even talk about what some call state terrorism. Well, let's move on to an email sent in from Mohamed Awari in Accra, Ghana, who wrote, African governments can strategically deal with the evolving problem of terrorism and violent extremism by engaging the youth in the creation of socio-economic opportunities. It is largely the lack of opportunities for self-fulfillment which drives the youth into criminal activity. Government and state security agencies must also engage in strategic intelligence and information sharing because extremism is increasingly becoming a transnational problem. And another comment from Chindefu Oble Kasoni in Lusaka, Zambia says, to stop the terrorists, you must stop their source of funding. If you resolve the root cause, they won't be able to show their ugly heads. But as long as funding is available, terrorism will be embedded into our lives. What about that? When you talk about funding, what about the marketplace? These guys have supporters.
And supporters that are in high government positions or external supporters. You know, there are reports that, you know, Boko Haram, as we know it today, you know, not what Mohammed Yusuf created in 2009, but this version with that, that has actually been splintered. It's not, they're not one all Nigerian. You know, so where are they, where are the other parts? Where are they recruiting from and who's sponsoring them? There are some theories out there about where they're getting their funding from. And even President Goodluck Jonathan said, you know, that he knows that members of his administration or the military have been infiltrated by Boko Haram.
Isn't that because of what you pointed out earlier, corruption?
Correct.
And I think, how does corruption come about? You have governments, frankly, who do not care about the welfare of their most prized public servants, the soldiers.
Yes, you are very right. The soldiers in Nigeria, I know that I spoke with a group that is working with soldiers in Nigeria. They have been so demoralized because they feel nobody understands their plight. They are not cowards.
Yes.
They want to fight. They are trying to support their communities and protect their communities. But they have no support from their leaders. Their leaders are corrupt. The people at the head of the military are corrupt. And then they are dying. They're being killed. These people are people that are putting their lives there. But there's no support for those who have been killed, their families. You know, when you can't take care of your own, then what are you supposed to do? We see how when, you know, someone in the military has been killed in the United States, you know, the procession that happens, you know, the draping of the flag, the support of the families, nothing happens when it comes to that.
Corruption, frankly, in a lot of situations begins at the top.
Yes.
You know, they say that a snake, what does it do?
The corruption in Africa, I think, is a multi-headed snake. Yeah. You keep cutting one off, it keeps cropping up in a different form.
A fish rots, a snake rots from the head.
Yeah.
That's all for today's social media segment. Just a reminder that we appreciate all of your social media feedback. Please keep them coming. Now let's take a look at what's on tap for next week's program.
Next week on Straight Talk Africa, Shaka goes in-depth with the Sierra Leonean president, Ernest Bai Koroma. That's next week, right here on Straight Talk Africa.
Welcome back, and today we are discussing combating terrorism across Africa and the ongoing efforts by governments and the international community to restore peace and stability. Well, I have to say that I have to apologize to you, Raymond, because I'm sure you wanted to say something. But unfortunately, there's no democracy in 52. If you are told to go, you have to go.
Absolutely.
So I hope you'll find some space in your beautiful Sierra Leonean heart and soul. Forgive me for that.
No problem.
Thank you. So what are the solutions, really?
Now, I think the solutions, first, we need to start at, to use your analogy at the head.
Because
we really need to clean up the governance deficit in Africa. And it's not just a capacity thing.
Right.
It's not just a political will thing. It's just the whole notion that the people serve the state. It has to be the other way around.
But what about the lack of social awareness or lack of political awareness among the vast majority of the people? Because governments have deliberately stayed away or refused to access them to civic education, to tell them about their constitutional rights. They're inalienable rights. They're birthrights.
I will say, which is, thank you for saying that, because that's part of what we try to do, is engage the ordinary citizen on these are your rights as a citizen of this nation. And what Raymond said is that the objective of a state is to serve the people, not the other way around. Mm-hmm. And we saw that. We've seen that since in Nigeria, for example, since the girls went missing, people have not stopped asking questions. Mm-hmm. Even with the elections that happened, you should have seen the constant chatter on social media.
Yes.
You know, Nigerians getting engaged. We hosted tweet chats asking what should the Nigerian government do regarding human security, education, corruption. And people were asking questions, were offering opinions and thoughts about what the Nigerian government could do. But it's really been a good thing to see how information about the election, where to get your voting cards, you know, so on and so forth. Even the counting and the reporting of the votes. People were engaged. So I think that we are seeing that Africans and this average citizen is no longer willing to just sit back quietly and let them be the victims or have the policies and actions of their leaders negatively affect them. They are pushing back and standing up and saying, you know what, we deserve better.
They are no longer willing to be what you would call willing victims.
Correct.
And you also have the emergencies of people like Professor Atahiru Jega doing his thing. A reminder that you are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. To participate in our discussion, please call us at 202-619-3111. The U.S. country code is 1. We'll continue our discussion in a moment.
We are able to touch on things that are important to people on an everyday basis. We hope that our viewers are getting inspired when they watch our show. They're getting a view of the world from a different perspective, things that perhaps are not in their immediate vicinity. Today, I could put in on the show something that is a little different, a little unique, and this gives me that inspiration to come to work.
If you like today's show, please write and tell us what you think or give us some suggestions. Be sure to tell us what station you're tuned into. Our address, Straight Talk Africa, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or send us an email at africatv@voanews.com. Log on to our website at voaafrica.com. Or post your comments on Facebook, keywords Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Gidui. And let's go to the lifeline of the show, which are the telephone callers. Good evening, Sam from Uganda. Samuel from Uganda, you're most welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Good evening, Dugushaka. How are you?
Dugushaka is hugely terrific. How are you today, Sam?
I'm very, very fine, and I'm looking forward to keeping on contributing to Straight Talk Africa.
It's good to have you back, and I hope next time I want to go to Kabale, you'll be more than willing to grant me a visa to go through Uruti.
I will excellently grant you one, sir.
Thank you very much. What is your question, Sam?
My question goes to the host. People on the program.
Mm-hmm.
What are the contingency plans of African governments to ensure that the army, the peacekeeping force of African Union, can be deployed in the soft targets like the schools and the hospitals, because the terrorists tend to attack the soft targets. So I remember when the Chibok girls in Nigeria were kidnapped, the First Lady of the United States came onto air and said that they should deploy and make sure that the girls are rescued. So what are the contingency plans of African governments to ensure that the army, which is being deployed all around the African continent, can infiltrate the soft target.
Thank you. I think your point is well made, Sam. Well, what about that, Professor Gilfin?
No, I think he's absolutely right. combating terrorism is a shared concern and should be a shared burden. And it's not just an issue of deploying the military, mm-hmm. but we need more effective policing. We need more effective social workers. Mm-hmm. We need more effective mechanisms to share information.
When you say effective policing, what exactly are you talking about? I think it would be good for the audience to hear exactly what you mean by that. Because you have police who probably sometimes, frankly, have no relationship with the communities that they operate in.
Absolutely. And I think you have just answered the question for me. You need police who not only have a relationship with the communities, but understand how to communicate that with the people that they serve and uphold the rule of law. And we usually have police, unfortunately, in many areas who are more predators than people who serve the people. Mm-hmm. But what we do need are community-based police forces that are able to respond expeditiously, mm-hmm. and that are also able to work with the communities so the communities are more aware of their rights, mm-hmm. and more aware of what to do when there is a problem.
Thank you. Still in East Africa, let's go to Tanzania. Good evening, Mpoki. You're most welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Ndugu Shaka. In fact, I should address you as sir.
You're most welcome, Ndugu Mpoki. What is your question?
Thank you, Ben. My question is that I would like to know why it's taking so long for the government to bring back the girls, and what has gone wrong in the Nigerian army that it failed to execute its normal duties as an army to secure the country.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Laura. I think you can really respond to that. You know, of course, as well as I do, at the beginning, there was even a little bit of resistance in Aso Rock.
Yes.
Through the first lady herself, whose name, of course, is Patience. She was wondering whether someone was simply trying to bring some political problems, frankly, to the first family.
Yeah, and it's that paranoia, unfortunately, that, is part of the prevailing thoughts in governance in a lot of African countries, that it's they're coming after me versus you hold a role, mm-hmm. you hold a public office, and they're coming for you to do what you're supposed to. I think we've talked about it. It's,
right.
you know, the lack of political will. I think that the president was in over in his head. I think he was, in a sense, blindsided, that they don't know what to do. And they were scrounging for how do we address this? How do we really don't know. And at the same time, you have to talk about the fact that there's so much going on. Who are we really going after? When we talk about we're going after Boko Haram. If Boko Haram is in the Nigerian military...
What is
if
there for me?
Exactly. Who are we really? Who is the enemy here? We have the image of who we know is the enemy, Abubakar mm-hmm. Shiku.
Mm-hmm.
However, on the ground, day-to-day level, people that are walking and living side by side by people who are in the military,
mm-hmm.
you don't know who they are. And until an attack happens or something happens when there's no response for 4 hours, when mm-hmm. people have called the police station, letting them know that, you know what, Boko Haram has said they're coming to attack us.
Mm-hmm.
4 hours, 5 hours, six mm-hmm. hours, nothing happens. What do you do then when people in your community are part of the terror or insurgency group that you're trying to fight?
Very
it's a very complex situation that has, and I think it has to go back to, we have to fix the external, the environmental factors that create and sustain such of a terrorist group.
Very
we have to make sure that there are ways of development, sustainable development, socioeconomic opportunities for people, not just men, women. Mm-hmm. Youth unemployment, which is high in mm-hmm. Nigeria, mm-hmm. has to be dealt with. You know, it's all those things, security, making sure that those people who are living right now as refugees, IDPs in camps, can come back to their home and rebuild.
Thank you very much. Let's go back to Uganda. East Africa is dominating today. After all, right here in the studio, there are two very intelligent people from West Africa. Good evening, Dennis from Uganda. You're most welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Good evening, Saka and the team inside the house.
I am hugely terrific. How are you?
I'm okay.
What is your question? Time is not our best ally, unfortunately.
Just a brief comment, Saka, today.
Uh-huh.
One, I would like to believe that no battle can be, no political battle and military battle can be accomplished just in the field. We need to go on top of the table.
Right.
Secondly, I would like to believe that the situation in northern Nigeria is not far from what we had in northern Uganda.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only when we can go to a round table that we can get to settle this matter finally.
Mm.
The terrorism is a very complex situation because I would like to believe, and most people will believe with me, that it has a relationship with it, has a correlation with the political, psychosocial, and cultural upbringing.
Uh-huh.
And if it is a psychosocial and maybe a mindset, then the upbringing is very fundamental.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And you might probably added, it may be political. And what is politics? It is about who gets what, when, where, and why. Earlier, you had a situation where someone said that if you educate a girl or a woman, you educate the world. But if you educate a boy or a man, you educate an individual. Is that true? Shouldn't we frankly be thinking about educating both?
Yes. And as a woman,
yes.
I know that globally,
yes.
Education for women is not often a priority.
True. Even though they are the ones who are, of course, euphemistically referred to as the ministers of interior.
I think it is and. You also have to educate men to also to educate men to understand that the rights of the women are important. You need to do both. So quite often it's always, you know, you either do you educate one group of people versus another, but you have to do both. But you also have to educate people to see each other's importance and each other's value.
But when you think about it, the person that most has power to socialize an individual is a female.
Yes.
Is your mother.
Yes.
What happens? Because not only do you carry the fetus or the kid, the baby, in your stomach for 9 months, but for the first 5-7 years, really, you have the power. Yes. And even when we grow up, the first reality, frankly, we have is to the mother. What happens?
Is
it about who controls culture, the thing called culture?
Yeah.
Raymond.
No, I think we really have to take a hard look at, you mentioned earlier, how do we value our prized assets? Mm-hmm. And usually we tend to undervalue on a gender basis, and we really need to address that.
Yes.
But if I may just very quickly address an earlier question about the military, why don't we have the military in? Boko Haram, as we know it, started in 2002.
Yeah.
It became radicalized in 2009 because of what the Nigerian military did. So as we think about the military, let's be really cautious.
Thank you very much. On that note, thanks to our distinguished guests, Laura Adele, also co-founder of Actor for Accountability, a Nigerian-American advocacy group based here in Washington, D.C., and Dr. Raymond Gilpin, academic dean of the Africa Center for Strategic Studies at the National Defense University here in the nation's capital. Thanks to our affiliate stations, along with our viewers and listeners, we thank you for tuning in. For many of our Voice of America radio affiliates, Learning English is coming up next. And tomorrow morning is Daybreak Africa with James Bate. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning in to Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, we get better, not bitter, Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.